Good evening. Welcome to another edition from the parent organization, eSchoolSistema.com. Today's topic is uses and abuses of curriculum in language and reading. Our guests are Professor Paul Ibarra from retired University of Wisconsin at Whitewater in administration, school administration. We have Professor Mark Seidenberg,
yes,
from a researcher in neuroscience. And we have Matt Watson from Bootstraps here in Madison. And I'm a parent representative for our community. I like to go back to my experience when I was learning to read and write, and as I was learning to read and write, how the Spanish language in my country was very important to me, and what it did for me. And what it did, it brought me into a personality of a culture that I feel proud of, and a culture that enlightened me to make interpretation of what symbols that take place in my mind. Such reflection helped me as I moved to the United States and I learned English as a second language. But I wonder, as I think about language and reading, what would have happened to the United States if our African American and Black students would not know how to read and write? And some of the leaders that are we value today, probably that we have never been reached to be leaders, to be recognized. With that said, I like to address that area. What are we doing in our schools with language and reading? Mr. Watson, why don't you tell us a little bit about Bootstraps, what's all about, and what you see in these areas?
Bootstrap is a nonprofit educational support after school program. And we're dealing with a lot of single family kids that come from broken homes, a lot of single mothers who really don't have a lot of time to spend with their kids as far as reading or going over homework. I have about 18 kids in my class that come to the program every day. And there's at least two that, that are in middle school but can't read very well. I sit down with them every day after school, and they just read to me, basically, 2-3 times each, And I think it just, I have to be honest, I think it starts within the family. We need help. Like I said, I take my hat off to the teachers because these are kids that I deal with about 3 hours every day. Teachers have them all day long. And, it's really hard to work individually when you have a classroom full of kids. So, we need community help. We need, parents, other siblings. We need everybody to pitch in because, it's unfair for any child not to be able to read. It's unfair. It's inappropriate. It's not acceptable. And I'm seeing it every day. I'm seeing kids that can read okay, but it's not where they should be as far as their grade level. And I'm struggling with this every single day.
I'd be very frustrated with that.
It's frustrating and it hurts. It really does hurt, especially when you're putting forth effort. And I have to go to the schools. I deal with teachers, I deal with principals, it's tough, especially when, when you're working hard and you're trying to help them, and just feel like you feel like you can do more, but I don't know.
So here we have a youngster, bright eyes, 11 or 12 years old, 13, kind of ready to want to learn in a classroom, yet can read, can write. On the other hand, we have people in the area of reading and writing talking about schematic reading approach, we talk about phonics, we talk about whole language approach. What's going on, Professor?
I'd like to ask the gentleman a question, because he was saying all the effort interests many people, and he still feels a lot of frustration. Have you ever stopped to think, why are you so frustrated that you're not getting the success that you wish you would get? And also, the other people who are talking to you never really have any, effective idea. Do you ever stop to think about that? Why are you in the situation you're in?
I think about it. Kids come to our program between 3 and 3:30, and it's, like I said, it's an after-school educational support program, and they're basically coming to do homework. And homework's from 3:30 to about 5 o'clock, and it's, which isn't like a lot of time, because usually we have speakers from the community that come in and educate kids on different topics. And, it's not a lot of time to actually, do as much as I'd like to do. But we're thankful that we do have tutors that come in from the university to help out. But, we have a lot of kids, and you need 2 or 3 tutors. It's very appreciated. It's helpful, but, we need more. We can use more. And anytime a kid does something to upset me or as far as not following the program, I'll make them copy the dictionary. Just so, I'll pick, a certain letter, and I'll make a copy, both copies on my page. I think it's beneficial. Somewhere, somewhere down the line, it'll help. And it makes me feel better, just to know that they're learning new words. I'll make a copy of the parts, whether it's a noun or a pronoun or whatever, and then the definition, all that. It's just frustrating because there's so many kids that we have that have learning issues. They have, learning disabilities. And, I just do what I can do, basically. I do my best.
Well, to answer your question, there's about 2-3 different ways the question could be answered. If I was in the classroom doing what this gentleman is doing, I probably would be looking at it from one perspective. But now I'm in a position to reflect back and ask questions that I have never heard asked before. Why do we try so hard, put so much money into all this, and yet we always come back and say the results are not really what we would like them to be? So if you look back, you find that if you want to focus on reading, you find that nobody's ever really discovered how reading is actually learning. Nobody really knows. We have a foundation in education that's based on social science, on the psychology of conditioning, stimulus and response. That's what you do. That's an unpredictable way of doing it.
It has nothing to do with what I do, actually.
I made a mistake when I went that way. And so we try hard, to condition the child to read, condition the child to do things, so forth. And that's usually time-consuming, right? Because we don't know exactly how much time each child needs and so forth. We have never really developed the knowledge that we need to be able to deal with the child individually.
Right.
And so we go at it and deal with the child in groups. So as we deal with groups, we miss a lot of children in the area and so forth. So the key question in reading, like we have had a debate, for the last 30 years between whole language and phonics. Right now, phonics is winning the argument again, right? So we went through so many generations using the whole language approach, and LA City school districts admit that they have all these generations of non-readers coming out in the last 30 years. So now they're back to phonics, phonic awareness, and all these programs that they've gotten back on, but there's never really been any clear evidence what program really works with what type of child, the characteristics of the child. So those are the problems that we have. So the only long-term evidence that we have is when we do direct destruction, which I call direct destruction today, which is the old-fashioned drill and practice. And if we use more drill and practice, I think we would probably have a higher rate of success instead of trying all the unproven bags and ideas that come along. And that's not answering the question how to teach the child. It's just saying, because we have nothing else, like this gentleman working, I think, in an area where they are getting solid scientific evidence would be very helpful for us. And that's the kind of information we need.
I think there. I agree with some things you say and disagree with some others. I think quite a lot is known about how reading works and how children learn.
Mm-hmm.
There is a huge amount of research on the causes of problems in learning to read. And the problem isn't that we don't know anything about how children learn to read. The problem is there's a disconnect between the research and the practice.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So, in fact, there are quite a few studies of practices that promote good reading and practices that are perhaps not as effective. There are outcome studies that are done on a fairly large scale, which compare different methods and provide evidence about which ones are more or less effective. We don't have the complete story, but I think we have quite a lot of information, and there's certainly plenty of research to build on. The frustration for a researcher like myself is we can say a great deal about the methods that are being used in many schools and why they don't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not so much that we don't have things to say or evidence, it's that we can't actually succeed in bringing it to bear on, you can't seem to influence the people who decide how the curriculum is structured.
What seems to be the problem influencing the people who make those decisions? What seems to be the problem?
There are different cultures. There is a culture of scientists and researchers like myself who are not in the classroom every day, but who have methods that allow us to look at how children learn, how reading works. We've studied it in different languages and different writing systems. We've looked at monolingual situations and bilingual situations. We've looked at a lot of different kinds of circumstances and factors that influence how children learn to read. So the researchers are off doing what they do. Then there are people in education schools who tend to be more connected to the school district and to the officials who are making the decisions about curriculum, who come from a very different background. They're not scientists, they don't know how to read the research literature, and we have these two different sorts of worlds, and it's been very hard to get them to communicate. So, and some people don't want to hear the message from scientists. There's a distrust of science in our culture right now, and there are people who, for a variety of reasons, are very invested in certain kinds of ideas about education, and you end up having a situation in which people are very well defended against, the kinds of research that we do. So it's a struggle. The thing that bothers me the most is that I think, to a large extent, schools like in the Madison Metropolitan School District have given up on a lot of the basic aspects of teaching. So if you look at the schools in Madison, some of them, the children seem to learn to read very well, and people are happy, and the parents think things are great, and in other schools, the children are doing less well, and they're going to programs like yours, and thank goodness they exist. And the question I would ask is, why do we need you doing all this work? If the schools were doing a better job, would it be that they'd have to fall upon you and volunteers and all this extra after-school stuff? If they were really doing the job they were supposed to do, we wouldn't need you at all. we ought to send them elsewhere. But I don't think they are actually fulfilling their responsibilities. And I have a little idea about this. Basically, what's happened is that the curriculum that they use assumes that there will be a lot of input from outside the school. There'll be parents around. There'll be computers in the home. There'll be video games that teach kids how to read and get them involved in reading because you need to read in order to play the game. There'll be the software. There'll be the parent who can help with the homework and so on. And in context, so the curriculum will work and be just fine if you have all this teaching going on outside the school. So that they built into the way that they do their teaching is an assumption that there's going to be help outside the school. And that is available in some parts of the culture, and it is not the society, and it is not available in other parts. What if you are in a home in which there aren't two parents there? Or there are two parents and they're off working? Or there are parents who do not speak English and can't help with the homework because they can't read it themselves? Or there isn't the computer in the home? Or they don't have the money to buy the software? To me, this way that the reading is taught now is extremely unfair, because it assumes that all these other resources are available. And you know what? They are for some people. And for those people, it works fine. And when the school district says, wow, the test scores are so great in this school, I say, well, what are they doing outside of the classroom? What kind of resources are available to those kids? Are those the kids who have got all these other advantages? So, you know, it seems to me that the curriculum is really quite unfair. And it's going to just exacerbate the differences between the good group has and have-nots and the good leaders and the poor leaders. And that's really tragic.
And I'm hearing some very two concepts here that we need to focus. One concept that I'm hearing, that there are two different cultures, the cultures, but there's a scientific culture group that has developed time in terms of how young students learn, and they have the literature, they have the research, but then you have decision makers who are in a different platform.
Right.
They're not in the platform. Mr. Barr, you were denying your head.
Well, I think you just verified what I just said about not knowing how to teach in schools, because like he was saying, we're not taking what is stolen and applying it, we don't have a means to apply it, and so forth. He just verified exactly, I agree with him 100%. That's really the problem, that we're not using proven ideas, approaches, and so forth, and getting them into the curriculum. The curriculum is always looking for a quick money maker by the publishers and so forth. So, there's John Medina, a biologist at the University of Washington, exactly wrote an article exactly on your points, that how the College of Education has to be sort of, you know, knocked down and rebuilt, and more science and teacher training and so forth. So I totally agree with that. But when I say that we don't know what we're doing, is because we use old ideas and recycle them, and we're not bringing in new information in, and we make it very difficult for the people who are developing the new information to get it in, because we sort of have a door that says we're only going to listen to what we already know, and they use all these things that you mentioned, you know, the two parent and so forth, and the kids that have it, they say, well, that must work on what we're doing, and so on. And what we have to learn, what I'm really meant to say, is that we have to learn exactly what is being discovered. There's a lot of studies all over the country. There's a lot known about how reading in Yale University and all the studies that are going on.
Yeah, our studies are better.
And I have a friend working on it in Arizona State that I work with him, and so on. So I know there's a lot of people working on it, and a lot of it's been discovered. But when I say we don't know, it's because they don't use it. And curriculum historically has been that way. You know, they started with that stimulus and response behaviorism, and we have stayed with that all along. And even if there's talk on the side of the cognitive approach and so forth, we don't seem to factor it into the. And also another thing that my background is that we never really look at the organization that we need. Schools were organized basically the way we have them now in the 1900s, you know, the time of the Industrial Revolution and so forth. We're no longer there. We talk about all the new approaches, new society and so forth, but the schools do not make any effort to change. And we're still the sixth period design and so on. So we really make it very difficult to bring in new structures into the old structure that we have. We have to modernize it like everybody else, modernize the organizational structures of schools. And those conversations are very hard to have because most people don't think that to get a new idea, you got to make a lot of changes. And the people always say, let's change, but they never change. You've been around a lot of change efforts, and at the end it comes out pretty much the same. And so forth. So there's so many elements and factors that impact in how schools are going to deliver instruction that it's very hard to get a group of people and really have a focused conversation because everybody's looking at it from a different perspective. And we know all that, but we haven't found a way how to address it.
I just wanted to make one specific point, which is there are a lot of reasons why the schools could be failing many children. I just wanted to point to one factor, which is it could be in part because of the way they're taught. And again, my sympathies are completely with the teachers here. The problem is what the teachers have been taught. And so this is such an enormous issue, and there are so many factors that are involved. I just tend to think that one of the things that gets overlooked is that we may be making the problems much worse because of the way that we teach children. And I really think we have a rich get richer kind of situation, and that the efforts from No Child Left Behind and things, programs like that, to try to help the children who are low achievers are not going to be effective if they're built on a foundation, if they're trying to work around teaching methods that are themselves part of the problem.
So what I'm hearing from you is that one important factor is how the teachers will be taught to teach.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
Well, if you go back to this idea of different cultures, one thing that I think has happened in education circles is, so we have schools of education which teach teachers, among other things, and they have developed over the past 100 years or so, they have their own culture, they have their own societies and practices and so on. And they tend to be different from science in an important way. In education circles, the person who has a big story and a big idea and a big personality can go directly to the educators, to the teachers, to the school administrators, and put over that idea, share the excitement, and enlist the teachers and others in trying out achievers. But in contrast to science, where what matters is the facts, the personalities of these sort of gurus have really played a huge role in determining what kind of practices have gotten accepted in the modern era. So you have people who were out, talking to teacher groups and talking to various education organizations and saying, I got a great idea. Let's teach reading this way. Here's a really cool idea. Why don't we think about children as learning to read the way that they learn to speak? So children learn to speak a first language very easily, and they don't require direct instruction, and they just kind of learn it naturally by being in an environment in which people are using language. So why don't we teach them to read that way? We'll just put them in an environment where reading is important, and we'll surround them with books, and we'll have all sorts of reading activities, and we'll try to make learning to read as easy as learning a first language. Well, learning to read is not like learning a first language. Learning to read is harder. Learning to read requires more instruction. Everybody learns a first language. Not everybody learns to read. Reading is something that typically requires some actual teaching. So, you know, but somebody came along with this idea, sold it like crazy. And so, you know, as a scientist, I would ask first, well, do you know if this will work? Is this actually a practice that's built on good ideas about how children learn? It's as though, you know, a drug company had formulated a new drug. And they were very hot on this drug, and they thought it was great, it was going to cure some horrible condition, and they started to give out the medication without having done any trials to see if it was effective or not. Education is like this kind of trying out a drug without having done the trials to make sure that it works. And a lot of the things that are done in schools are experiments that are being done on huge numbers of children. And some of them are failed experiments where the methods don't work. So, you know, as a scientist, I try to ask questions like, well, why don't you show me what the evidence is that this works as opposed to this? How could we decide if this method was better than this without, you know, guessing, without just relying on some authority person to tell you, I think this is a great idea. So, you know, we try to do research that tells us what the practice suggests what the good practices should be. And that's just not traditionally something that's incorporated in teacher education. I taught the first course at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that had the word dyslexia in the title. Dyslexia is a very common term for children who have constitutional problems that make it hard for them to learn to read. But for some reason, the education schools around here don't want to recognize that this is a condition. So you have a split between the education world and the science world, and the way the teachers are taught is often based on, you know, the ideas of these charismatic kind of figures who really have sold them a product that may not be very good.
Yeah, I think in the educational circles, you know, that I remember when the name Pogan, I was teaching fifth grade class, bilingual rhetoric class. Pogan has been entitled one, which they were taken out of the class, we thought to read for 5 years. He was in the fifth grade. And when I was his teacher, I learned that he could not distinguish any of the symbols, any of the vowels to the symbol. Yet he has spent hours out of the classroom drilled in terms of these symbols. His predominant language was what we call Tex-Mex. So cognitively, there was some patterns in his mind that was taking place that needed to decode different sounds and put it in a context of sound and symbol. And that's what I needed to work with. But as a teacher at that time, I was looking at his cognitive development. Where is Ruben? Why did he give you reverse from one sound to another? If I show him an A, can he learn that this is not, he becomes to an I? Can he see the difference? How can he hold on to the memory?
Well, there are people, children, who, because of various sorts of problems that we are starting to identify with the ways in which their brains are structured, who find learning to read very difficult. But they are a relatively small proportion of kids. We're talking about many kids who could be reading better than they are. And it's not because they have some intrinsic problem or there's something wrong with them. There are other things that are interfering with their being able to learn to read. They're not getting the right kind of instruction. For whatever reasons, they're not getting the support at home. And there aren't enough other resources to fill in the gaps. And so these kids are having a lot of trouble.
The research that you're talking about, is there, what does it look like? Do you give them some tests, external tests?
We look at how kids read. So sometimes we go into schools and we bring our little computers in and we have them read texts. We can see what kinds of mistakes they make when they're reading. We can time how long it takes them to read things. We can look at their eye movements while they're reading. Sometimes we bring the children into the lab so that we can look at them under more controlled sort of conditions. And now the state of the art is that people are beginning to take children 7, 8, 10 years of age and putting them in the brain scanning devices, and we can get a picture of their brain activity while they're reading. So, and indeed we can see the patterns of brain activity that are associated with children who are having problems to read and the problems that are associated with being a skilled reader, and we can try to see what the neural circuitry is. So we look at data, we look at facts about how people read and things that promote good reading and things that that work, you know.
So can we visualize a university that gives the student who can a teacher to experiment with this type of methods?
Well, I have to agree with the other speaker that the schools of education have been part of the problem. Typically, there are other people people study reading from and learning and child development from other perspectives. But you know what? Universities are like other institutions. They end up having their groups, and they don't necessarily talk to one another all the time. And they have different philosophies from different orientations. So it's like trying to talk to someone from a very different culture. It's difficult. You have to take extra, put up extra effort into it.
So part of the problem I came to the 90s has to do a lot with teacher training.
Absolutely.
The a lot of the problem has to do that we have two sides. We have the scientists not talking to the decision maker. The decision makers, I don't know too much about science.
Well, now here's the kind of problem that shows up. So now after a period of whole language, people are saying, well, put some phonics back into the early education. Early reading curriculum. And, you know, when I talk about phonics, I'm thinking about there's a period when the kid is in kindergarten or first grade where teaching them about the letters and the sounds is very important. It's not the only thing, but it's a really important step. And so it is something that you want to have as part of your curriculum. So then we say to teachers, well, you need to include some of that in your curriculum. The problem is the teachers will have come out of training programs some years ago and won't necessarily know what techniques are effective for teaching that stuff. And so, indeed, they may have been taught that it was something that you shouldn't expose children to. They may not have been taught methods for teaching it effectively. So when they try, it may not be as effective. So even if the spirit is willing and people want to change the curriculum, they have teachers who have come from different backgrounds and different will have been trained, you know, at different times and been told different things. So and they may not be able to implement the best practices even if we know what they are.
You
know, I can't help it. I mean, it might be wrong, but I can't help it. This gentleman just sort of articulated our campaign last year. I just can't help it because it was all based on what he's just finished saying to us, our pursuit to the superintendent's office. I can't disagree with anything he said because that's basically what we ran on. And like I said, Medina identified that about 10 years ago that the College of Education has to become more science orientated. Because you can't just take a teacher and say, I don't want to expose to all these findings if they have no background, no training in science. So he made the statement, and he says that he felt uncomfortable writing that statement because he's only a biologist. Somebody in education should be writing an article asking that the colleges of education be restructured and the training of teachers be more scientific orientated, and you know, he's been doing this for a long time in Seattle, University of Washington, Seattle, and you know that was our focus a year ago. That the training of teachers needs a lot of improvement.
Matt, did you know this? I mean, here you are, simple man. You work with Yantus every day. They come to you, you're right there, simple educator, right there, bootstrap. They come to you. But were you aware that this phenomena, cheap patient training is lacking?
Not in such depth or such detail. The school board, Madison Metropolitan School District, you know, they do a lot for our program. So I can't, you know, like as far as, you know, the whole teaching method and everything, not so much my cup of tea. You know, I'm sure that there is that what you say makes a lot of sense.
Hey, they show up on your doorstep. They show up on your doorstep and you have to have to do your best to help.
Basically, that's it. But what I am finding, though, is that we're getting a lot of homework, you know, that doesn't explain a lot as to what the teachers want. And the kids don't know what the teachers want. That's a problem right there. You know, so how can you do something if you don't even know what's going on, you know, or what the teacher's asking for? I think it does. I'm a little nervous. You guys got to excuse me, but I really think that it's not so much the teachers. You know, it's the home too. I mean, you have to know what your kids. You have to be interested in what your kids are doing and what they're bringing home. And what you said made a lot of sense about, you know, the whole culture thing, because we get kids that will bring homework with any internet access. They don't have computers. So how in the world are they supposed to get that done? You know, thank God for our program, because we have computers and internet access. They can, you know, log on and get the, you know, the criteria done. But
what was that curriculum designed? You know, what kids was that curriculum designed for? The one that requires them to go out and use the internet. It assumes that they're
right.
Was made up for kids who have access to
that. Definitely. And, one thing I've learned is that I have 18 kids that are completely different. You know, but they also come from different backgrounds, all walks of life. And they're mostly, you know, minority kids or kids, people, you know, kids of color, whatever. And, I guess teachers give, you know, each kid in the classroom the same work, you know, but when I work with these kids, I have to work with each kid differently and individually, because they all have different needs that need to be met. You know, I can't deal with them all on the same level, and I think that's what these teachers are doing. They're dealing with each kid on the same level instead of, you know, taking out individual time, probably because they don't have the time to do it.
Yeah, I don't want to blame the teachers. I feel sympathy for the teachers who have enormous burdens and a difficult job. I am concerned about what the teachers are told.
Right. That.
And if the school district can put more support into programs like yours, that would be great. I would like, in an ideal world, we do a better job in the classroom and we have more successes. And maybe we can make further progress towards that.
And the question goes on, you know, where's public education?
Well, you know, if you look at it and you take evidence, if you look into all the evidence that has been accumulated, say, in the last 30 years, well, study has a 30-year history of it, they've been looking at it 30 years. There's one approach that highlights, you know, that it works better than any other approach that we know right now, that's direct instruction. And direct instruction is challenged a lot in schools because, you know, they talk about constructivism and, you know, so forth. And we have those debates. Like your children, basically, like in Milwaukee, the schools that use direct instruction seem to, you know, are more successful than the ones that do not. But the thing is that approach becomes debatable. And even with the evidence that they have, it's still debatable by the school people. And you talk to some of the schools in the inner city of Milwaukee, they just have 100% confidence in the approach. Yet other schools will not use it because somebody in the other school says, well, I went to a workshop. Well, I heard somebody else indicate how successful this other approach would be. So I think schools that are dealing with reading problems, at this time when the information isn't integrated into curriculum designs and so forth, direct approach probably would be the best way, where you would have probably a higher rate of probability of reaching working. And that's not saying you want to reach 100%.
Can I just add a little bit of something to that? I think what the evidence suggests is that for children who are at risk, that is, for children who are not benefiting from a lot of instruction at home, they don't have the parents who are hovering over them all the time and teaching them the letters and letter sounds and so on from the time they're two. For children who are at risk, direct instruction is effective because the kids won't have learned these basic elements of reading elsewhere. But there are other kids who will have gotten that. There are other kids who have gotten that because they were looking at Reader Rabbit when they were four years old. And so for those kids, they're past direct instruction. They're off to the next thing. So, yes, it's important. What's important is that the child learn those building blocks of what the letters are, what they sound like, be able to read the words effectively so they can go on to other things. Do they get it in the home because they're lucky? Do they get it in the school because they have direct instruction? Do they get it from your after-school program? How are these kids going to get those skills so that we can go on to teach them other things?
And I don't want to hang up here on just the basics, because how about on the top, comprehension? How are youngsters who can read? How are youngsters who assimilate the reading, visualize what's happening? And are we teaching, for example, classical literature? Are we making comparison of romanticism versus existentialism versus transcendentalism? Can somebody interpret the poetry of Ralph Waldo Emerson? What's happening to those mentors? That is part of reading.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a focus, a lot of the heat is directed at getting the kids off the, a lot of the debate is about getting the kids off the ground. How do you get them from not being a reader to to getting into the system? But once you're into the system and learning a little bit about how reading works, how the child, once the kid's learning a little bit about reading, there's much more. And so, although the focus is on getting everybody to or at least have some basic skills, that's not the whole story.
How can we compare social states with literature? What's taking place and what's the product of literature comes out from history?
That's a question that I know you'd like to ask, but if you're in a school like when I was in public school,
right,
I'm not going to be worried about that. Because I'm worried about the basics. Can I get this? Because, I still work for a bureaucracy from the state. If we put expectations, they say, if you don't reach this level by a certain time, we're going to penalize you.
Right.
And then all these factors are in. I'm not going to be worried about that. I'm going to be worried about that California achievement test when they give it and see where these children are placed. Because, California is saying if you don't reach that level, we're going to cut you by so much money, right? Yeah, because we're going to make you accountable and all this accountability. So those are like the granddad. He goes to this school that they already know that they have the skills, these basic skills, so they move into the next step. And they're doing the things that you're talking about. But to have a kid, like I don't know exactly. I know you're working with children having difficulty. So I try to use the Milwaukee Public Schools that identify, they're in the inner city and so on. Their focus is getting the basics on. You understand the sounds, you read, basic reading is very important for them and all that. That's the next step, but we can't get into that step until we do this. So, like a lot of people describe school is designed like an assembly line. You put this part in the next grade level, another part in the next grade level, another part, and hopefully, after 12 parts are inserted, we can call this person a high school grad. They made it that way. And if you investigate this, what they identify the skills needed for first grade, second grade, and third grade were just arbitrary. They just said we got to divide this into 12 parts, so then we divide into 12 parts, and this makes sense. And that's what we started. We haven't changed it that much. The school was pretty much the way it was started. Back 100 and some years ago.
And that's what I'm hearing, but I'm also hearing that we don't have a professional institution to develop teachers that can come out. And what I'm also bringing up to the point here is that we have youngsters in the elementary who beat me in the basics, but then they get to the middle school and they're missing the basic, but now instead of getting interested in literature, in the poetry, in the comprehension part, now they're starting to wrap their way through middle school without knowing how to read and write.
Did you see 2020 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, Stupid America.
Yeah, Stupid America. What did they identify for you? They identify the longer the student stays in school, the less proficient the student is. They said the fourth grade they do fairly well, and they had this world testing, right? Because they said America is 17th in the world, and they did this whatever test they gave. And then they said fourth grade they do fairly well, but not at 12th grade. So what they were saying, what Stoffel was saying, is that something happens as they go through school that they lose proficiencies when they compare with other countries around the world.
And that's my point. That is my point. Why is it that a youngster from another country can come, but reads and writes, interest to learn English, and by the time they are 16, they're able to speak English?
Did you see that the schools that he visited overseas? Did you see how structured they are? They're very structured. They're very conditioning takes place well. The behavior science or the behaviorism is taking place well. They condition the children well. And even the schools that he saw here in the United States, when he went to schools that were doing better than the public schools, what did you see? Children from the inner city and so forth, but what were they doing? Structured classrooms, sitting there with ties. Very, very structured. The conditioning that we know in education is being applied well there. I don't think we can say that about the public school system.
I have to say, I don't think of education as conditioning. And I think there are different reasons to look at why. We should be looking at why some schools are more successful than others. But it isn't a question of conditioning. It doesn't have very much to do with behaviors or anything like that. We may not have that much respect for education in this country. We may have watered down standards. We may have low expectations. We may have children who are interested in other kinds of pursuits. We may have a lot of societal issues that contribute to the kind of decline that happens between fourth and eighth grade. But now we're getting into a different set of issues. One set of issues is about how to get kids off the ground and into learning. There are certainly other issues that arise to keep them going and expanding their horizons and learning more things and being interested in education and being able to do the other things that we need for success. And I certainly don't think reading and phonics is the thing that will guarantee success in all these other areas. It's just one of the building blocks and one of the sort of necessary preconditions.
I would disagree, because if you look at the history of education, the design of education was based on behaviorism. The design, the beginning design of the 1900s was behaviorism. We have not introduced much more information besides that is, that is acceptable. That's when it started. That was the new science of the 1900s. And we used it. All my experience in the public school system, that's exactly what we did. Behaviorism. It's an argument if that's what the correct way to use it or not, that's always been an argument. And some people disagree. They think, the DISTART program that they did for Appalachian Black children, people said that's too harsh. It's too pounding program that's over repeat. So we have always had those arguments, but we've never been able to resolve it. And you know, so when you look at this, and again, that the problem is one program should reach out to our person. You know, that has always been a weakness with education, that they have been trying to get one curriculum and then apply it to all children. And the districts will look at a curriculum, salesperson comes in, they buy a reading program, then they apply it to all. And those have been weaknesses as we go along. But those are debates that we need people to provide evidence to get us beyond the debate.
And I think that's a different topic in there, too, that, you know, in terms of where education is from, behaviorism, not behaviorism, in terms of from a different perspective. I think going back to language and reading, and coming back to some things that we have talked here tonight, because we go back to the answer campus, or the answer they go to another program in the schools. And what I'm hearing here tonight, that is a concept here, that the curriculum is set up for the youngsters who have those privileges at home. What happened to 45% of the population who is qualified for free and reduced lunch, qualified for high school quality, won't have a father and mother at home? What's happening to that? Where is the citizens, the voters, are to call the attention that we need to reach these youngsters in reading, in writing, because they don't have the supports in their environment?
Well, you look at it. When the design of education comes in, they have a different mission. It's the Industrial Revolution when we start the efficiency system in education and we build these large complexes to educate children and so forth. The majority of your administrators are coming out of Stanford, trained more on a tailored scientific management approach of management of an organization. So they bring all this in, and the idea was to create people for the industrial companies. So the need to move the child to the level that we want them there wasn't there. You know, they got them to perform, say, third, fourth grade level, and that was good enough. They could go out there and get a job and maintain themselves and so forth. Today, that is not good enough, right? And we're still using a lot of notions, approaches that we used way back then. And today, the expectations and the demands of education have shifted tremendously. It's a lot higher expectations of the child's performance, and we're not satisfied with 30% graduation rates. Like in 1900 in St. Louis, Missouri, the drop-off rate was like 90%, 1% graduation rates. It didn't alarm anybody. And today, look at how many people who actually graduate, a lot higher, but now we're asking a different question. We're asking the ability the child brings out from the school. Not the fact that they graduated. Now we're saying, what kind of proficiencies, ability levels do you have? So we have shifted the questions in the evaluations of schools. Also, what we have done is that we compare education globally. In one time, we did not. So it's a whole different, say, ball game, like a lot of people like to use that phrase, that we're looking at in expecting for education to do things that, and yet we need people like this gentleman here to produce the evidence and knowledge that we need to move into the new era of education.
We have like one more minute, but it sounds to me that the big point here is that we have two cultures. We have the management culture, the school culture, administrative point, and we have the scientists, and they're both are not talking to one another.
First thing, we have the education culture.
And then we have the teachers, with the teachers, unfortunately, I feel compassion for the situation, because there's a lack of knowledge when it comes to the teaching profession.
I think many teachers use methods that they've based on their accumulated knowledge and experience and are highly effective because they learned what works. But we could certainly do a better job of integrating the science into trying to communicate more of it to the education schools. I should say, though, you know, science can also be manipulated. So it is, you're not free to just look at certain facts and ignore other facts. But in the world today, science can also be used for different purposes. And so it's really important to try to maintain objectivity and see what the facts actually suggest and enact best practices and try to leave aside our sort of preconceptions.
And with that said, I think we can open the floor for discussion. But we will try to encourage that we keep some objectivity in the profession we do. It is not about the clinician, it's about being objective.
Yeah, I do have a question along points that Mark was just making. Certainly I've read, but it's not, well, it may be that there's not much science going on in the education area as compared to what the kind of science that Mark is doing. However, a lot of these studies that show this is the great way to go, great way to go, this new fad is going to work, there certainly is a substantial amount of quote-unquote research on this so that people are not just the biggest, you know, the one who has the most characteristics or a good advocate for their particular approach. They seem to say they have something that works. The studies show that. But as you pointed out, you can manipulate this stuff, and the issue is any of this stuff any good? What's wrong with the, if the science that education research is doing is lousy science, because they are finding, they are justifying their positions.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say all there's, I just can't generalize about all education research. There's some education research that is outstandingly fine. The question is whether people are doing the right, asking the right sorts of questions. Are they going out, comparing method A to method B under comparable conditions where you could see whether one of them is more effective or than the other? A lot of research in education has an exploratory character. People are like trying out new ideas, and that's interesting. The problem comes when people try to implement these ideas on a big scale without really knowing whether they're going to work or not. So when you see a study that says some new method or new approach might be promising and there's some indication from a little study that it worked with 10 kids, that's not enough. You need to have it more thoroughly worked out and evaluated before you try it out on millions of kids, which is what's happened in the past.
Follow-up question. When you're working in bootstrap with middle schoolers or early high schoolers who can't read or can't read at the level they should be reading, what's their attitude towards that? I'm not sure I can ask the question right. Are they angry? Are they sad? Are they blowing it off and saying it's not important? What's their attitude at that stage in life towards their own abilities?
The kids?
Yeah.
What I've been seeing is a lot of embarrassment.
Embarrassed.
Ashamed, hurt. Because kids, you know, kids are. I mean, I remember being in middle school and, you know, having to read out loud and listen to other kids read out loud. And if you pause between each word, it was funny to me. You know, and it's still funny to these kids, you know, today. And
these kids know they can't read.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, they're not.
They know. I mean,
know.
They'll never tell you that. You know,
oh yeah.
But
oh,
they
yeah.
know. You know. And you know, kids like that, I mean, you take them out of the classroom, and you know, depending on the amount of staff we have, you know, we work with them individually. You know, that's why tutors are so valuable to us, so helpful, because you know, I mean, when you work with kids that are at risk, your supervision has to be up to par. And, you know, it's real hard you know, to separate yourself, to work with the kid individually, because you never know what's going to happen. So it's tough, you know, but, you know, with all the budget cuts and all the money, you know, being taken away and put into other, I won't even say programs, just to whatever they do with it, I don't know. But, you know, it's making it more and more difficult. And, you know, we're talking about the teachers, you know, maybe not being trained as well, and, you know, the parents at home, things like that. And, you know, what about the city? You know, the politicians that take the money away. I mean, I can't see it getting any better with all the budget cuts. I mean, no matter what we do. You know, because we all have to be there for each other, you know. Like, I mean, with you and your research, very valuable. And, you know, just, you know, with the teachers and then with the community. I mean, we have to do this together. We can't just look at the teachers. We can't just look at the parents. We have to look at each other, you know, and bring awareness. So.
Yeah, I understand. And then there's a comment from our guest.
I just want to add to this question. That your question leads to what the American Educational Research Association is facing. Right now, there's a tremendous debate going on. That the educational researchers are saying that we have to upgrade our research and make it more rigid, more vigor in it. There's another group that says, no, we're satisfied with what we do it now, doing these cursory studies with 10 people, 12 people, and not have long-term approaches to it. So educational research is in a crossroad right now. Whoever side wins this argument is going to determine where research will move into the next decade. So it's a question within educators, researchers and educators about the research that we're doing.
So. Okay, this is I'm Gerd with it. This is a short story of a friend of mine named Joe Ramirez. Joe Ramirez and I, we were cross-country runners. Joe couldn't read. He was 12 years old. He couldn't read. The coach picked him up little by little. He started learning to read. He was in high school. He still couldn't read, and he still was running track. And everybody around him said that he was going to be a failure. Well, Joe Ramirez, he learned to read. He graduated from high school. He has a master's in biology. He owns his own karate clinic. He owns several houses, and he's doing well. So we don't know what is out there for any of us. What we do know is that we have to think seriously about our education. Thank you.
Thank you.